The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, we'll be talking about a fascinating and perhaps not as well-known way of achieving well-being and emotional resilience called CBCT, or Cognitively Based Compassion Training. I'm joined by Timothy Harrison. Tim is Associate Director of CBCT at Emory University Center for Contemplative Science and Compassion-Based Ethics. He oversees the many CBCT programs, including multiple research initiatives and the rigorous teacher certification process. Tim regularly teaches CBCT nationally and internationally in academic institutions and healthcare settings, and he advises on the tailoring of CBCT for research with unique populations, including cancer survivors, veterans with PTSD, HIV-positive patients, and Emory medical students. Tim has a master's degree in architecture from Harvard University, and he has most enjoyed offering CBCT in outreach programs such as prisons and foster care homes and to teachers in the Atlanta public school system. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I want to start by asking you to explain the terminology. Like, what is CBCT?
Explaining the cognitively based compassion training.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, there's a lot in that.
It's a big question.
It is a big question. Probably the most important word in there is compassion. And it's central to our program. It's actually central to our whole center here at Emory. And it's important to understand what we mean when we say compassion, that we're talking about an aspect of being human being that's very natural for human beings. It's just this part of us that is able to care for others, take the interest of others into account. And it's pretty clear not many of us would be here if we hadn't been a recipient of compassion at some point in our life, probably for many years as we were clothed and fed and taken care of. And that's all we're talking about. I mean, it's very simple. It's not a magical quality or one that's unusual. It's really very common. Society wouldn't really work without people having this sense of care for others and taking care of others. So, as you know, being a physician yourself, you see it every day. So, why then do we need to train this quality?
I was just going to ask
if it's so common and natural, why would it need some training? Well, as common as it may be, we also have limitations to our compassion, maybe both at the level of how deeply we feel it toward others, but also who we include in our circle, if you will, of compassionate concern. So it also seems natural that human beings, like other primates, have a kind of in-group bias. We, without really choosing to do this, as we grow up, we develop certain, prejudices or biases and say, well, these people, say people in my family or my friends, or in some cases people who look like me or go to my same church or vote like I do, those people I can have compassion for. But if you're not in that circle, it's harder for me to have that feeling of wanting to take care of you and take your concerns into account. So that is one area where our training is targeting making a difference, to help us see when we are really against our will, drawing this line around an in-group and saying, wow, I care for those people. And it's not that we're saying you should go out and care equally for everyone, and that's a pretty tall order. Maybe that's your goal. I don't know. But really we're offering the practices that we offer with CBCT give you a chance to consider, am I drawing my in-group more tightly than I would like to be drawing it? Can I be more inclusive? And would it be of benefit to me to include more others, to be less biased? So that's one of the training components. The other training component is actually not in the title of CBCT, but it's as important as compassion for us, and it's resilience. And many people who are familiar with meditation, mindfulness practices, might have heard that these practices can help us with stress tolerance or stress relief. But in our program, we use very similar mindfulness techniques that you might find in other programs, but the practices help us sustain our resilience in the face of stress, not just for our own well-being, but also so we can be more available to others and be able to bounce back when confronted by their difficulties, their struggles. So those are two ways that we consider compassion to be trainable and supportable.
And, you know, you just touched on so many topics that I want to circle back to. So the first is, you know, as you said, we do perhaps have a bias with our inner circle. What is the advantage or benefit to people to go through compassion training, to feel compassion towards people that may have different views, aren't in their inner circle? Like, why would someone do this?
Sure. Well, that's a wonderful question. And actually reminds me of the initial research done on CBCT back in 2005 when it was first developed here at Emory by Professor Lobsang Negi, who's a professor in the religion department and the director of our center. At the time, he was collaborating with a psychiatrist named Charles Raison. And Charles Raison was an expert in depression and stress and their relationship. And he had this idea that one of the things that made human beings so stressed and so able to sustain a stress response that was keeping their immune system overly inflamed, that was causing cortisol, adrenaline, these very stress hormones to be flooding, I'm not a scientist, so forgive me if I misspeak, but, flooding that inner neurological blood system, was that his hypothesis was that we in our modern society have a tendency to overrate the amount of danger we are in as we walk through our world. So it was very helpful when we lived on the savannah and there were lions and tigers around to have this ability to suddenly become fearful and have that stress response and fight, flight, or freeze, run away. But somehow we've been able to transfer that skill now to what you might call a fear of social rejection or a fear of the way others think about me, the fear of being judged. And so it seems like many parts of our modern society have us walking through the world with this kind of fear response on high activation. And Dr. Raison said that is actually causing our entire body to be on alert as if we've just been bitten by a wild animal. And that response is wonderful in the short term, but in the long term, it causes so many of the chronic diseases that really, you're the physician, so you know more about it. You're nodding, so you agree. That really get all of us in the end, even cancers related to this type of stress response, but diabetes, heart disease.
Yes, the link being inflammation in a lot of these cases triggered by the stress.
Yes. So the early studies with CBCT actually showed a decreased response of inflammation. Interleukin-6 was measured in the blood in response to social stressors. And this led to a whole host of research projects. But to get back to your question, for me to walk through the world, including more people in my in-group, means that I have a lower fear response, a lower stress response to the people I'm sharing the planet with, going into the grocery store, You know, in CBCT, we have a very simple practice we call Just Like Me, where you, as you see someone, you may not even know them, but you, instead of just kind of writing them off or judging them for, you know, having bad hair or in bad breath or whatever you may naturally notice, you think, well, this person has a whole life that I'm not aware of, but in their life, I don't know much about them, but I do know they want to be happy and free from distress and harm, just like me. This is a basic practice, and over time, if that can become our kind of normative response to people we are interacting with, it just softens that those other kind of judgmental, sometimes aggressive responses that we have that aren't really hurting the other person. They're hurting us because of what they're doing internally to us.
Yeah, which is such a great way to say that compassion clearly benefits the recipient,
sure.
Right? We all want to be on the receiving end of compassion.
Sure.
But what's really interesting about the work that the center has done with Dr. Raison is that it benefits the person who feels more compassion, so both the giver and the receiver.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this compassion, so there are many levels to this. There's compassion towards strangers, mm-hmm. towards enemies, and towards the self.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk through what the training process is like when people are training in compassion-based training?
Sure. So CBCT consists of seven different contemplative practices. You might call them meditation. But that word has a lot of baggage, and a lot of people think of it as going into a trance or, escaping reality in some ways. This is not at all what the CBCT practices are about. If anything, they're helping us attune more to the reality that we live in. That's the goal. So we actually start with a little practice we call resting in a moment of nurturance, where we help our body to calm down, our immune system to calm down in the moment by just thinking of a time or a place where we have felt more settled, more safe, more secure. And this is a kind of body settling practice that then allows us to engage some of the learning that happens in the following practices. Once we do that, we turn our attention to our attention, which is a basic meditation practice. If you've ever done any kind of mindfulness, you'll know that the main thing any meditation is doing is directing your attention towards something and seeing if you can hold it there, and then noticing getting distracted and coming back. And this way is another way of stabilizing the mind, calming the mind, and beginning to notice, what is the mind doing when I'm not looking, so to speak? What sorts of patterns does it have? It gives me a sense of kind of like a physician examining the symptoms. Like I can see, these are the types of thoughts that recur. With those basic practices in place, we then turn to what we call the cognitive parts of CBCT. This is why it's called cognitively based compassion training. And we start asking, are these thoughts I'm having that helpful? Are they that realistic? And we actually begin, you made the point, it's a very good one, with ourself. How do we respond to ourself? So we go, we have a whole section, what we call self-compassion. First, before we talk about extending compassion to others. And the idea there is that many of us, not everyone, but many of us in this culture seem to have a relationship with ourselves that's quite harsh and judgmental. And when we take a look, we begin to see that we say things to ourselves about our appearance or our professional success or our relationship success, or, you know, we have this way of criticizing ourselves internally. We say things to ourselves inside that we would never say to our friends, you know, if they're having a hard time. So the first, and in some ways the most important part, is to develop a new way of talking to ourselves, where we see that our limitations, our vulnerabilities, our adversities are not something that we're experiencing alone. We're not the only person who has some flaws or problems or setbacks. This is actually part of the human condition to not be perfect. When we teach in the med school, this is a really important one. A young med student, you know, I think, still has that sense of I'm gonna get everything just right forever. And they can get a lot of things right, but not forever. And, you know, human beings are not perfect, and it's the nature of things. So can I start to then see myself with a greater sense of kindness and acceptance of the things that I can't change? Now, of course, there are things I can change. I'll keep trying to do that. But there's some things that I cannot. So that's self-compassion. From there, we turn our attention to others. And we, as I mentioned, the Just Like Me practice, we practice remembering, being mindful, if you will, that other people are just like me. They have their limitations. They have their vulnerabilities. They have ways of thinking that they're not entirely in control of either, that are causing them problems. And so now, all of a sudden, I can relate to them. I can identify with them. And really, you can't have compassion without empathy. Empathy being understanding another person's perspective or how they're feeling. Compassion is not the same as empathy, but we can come back to that. But you can't have empathy if you don't identify with someone, if you don't see that on some level they're like you on some level. And actually, Franz de Waal, who's this incredible scientist here at Emory, studying primates for 40 years. That's one of the major conclusions from his research, and it's in a wonderful book called The Age of Empathy. Identification is the primary portal to empathy. So if you want to understand someone, you need to spend some time making sure you see how much they're like you at some fundamental level. Then from there, that sense of common humanity, we spend time considering how much we depend on others for our well-being. And this helps us with what I'm sure you've talked about on this podcast before, but gratitude, the benefits of feeling grateful. Because as social beings, not a single person on this planet is able to survive by themselves. We depend, and then in our society, this global society, we're depending on people from all over the world every day to provide us with our phones, our food, our clothes, our shelter, this technology we're using for this podcast. You could just imagine the millions of people who've contributed to simply us having this conversation. And again, that can shift the way we relate to people as we go through the world. So these two things, awareness of interdependence, awareness of common humanity, are mindfulness practices that in the end allow us to feel connected to people, and that is what allows for compassion.
So the training, as you said, starts with the self, with mm-hmm. self-compassion, being more aware of kind of our negative self-talk, yes. and then moves on to really paying attention of how we respond to others mm-hmm. and looking for the shared humanity. And for our listeners who may be interested in trying the cognitively based compassion training, mm-hmm. is this something that people can do at home? Does it have to be in a group setting where it's something that's trained through various exercises?
Well, the course is originally designed as a 10-week program where you would each week learn from a teacher the basic practices, practice them together in a group setting, and then go home and try it on your own. And we have all sorts of recordings and written materials as well to help support home practice. But then each week you could come back, ask questions, learn the next part of the practice, so that after these 10 weeks, sometimes an 8-week format, you have the skills to continue the practice on your own. It's not as simple as just, say, a 30-minute lesson. There's this one thing that you just do every time, and it has more complexity than that. So we are working on a book about CBCT that's been around 15 years now almost, so it's time for that. which I think will be wonderful. People could read that and probably get a lot out of it. But for now, you would need to find a course in CBCT. And if I may share our website address, compassion.emory.edu, lists the courses that are available. So.
And they're available to the public.
And there are, yes, four times a year we offer courses to the public. We have a teacher certification program with dozens now of teachers, many in the Atlanta area, who are offering CBCT, sometimes through their own private practice or at schools. And those people are listed on the website as well. So it's out there.
That's great. And I want to circle back to what you're seeing in terms of the research as an outcome mm-hmm. from the CBCT. You know, you mentioned the decrease in inflammatory markers, mm-hmm. the physiologic effects, which are tied to health benefits because all of the chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes, right. et cetera, are linked to inflammation. And at the very beginning, you also mentioned emotional resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about how resilience is built through CBCT?
Sure. Let's see. There are several ways, actually. It's not just one of the practices that helps with resilience. But actually, before I get into that, I'll just say that one of the somewhat counterintuitive parts of CBCT is this idea that compassion actually helps with resilience. Sometimes we think, well, I can see how being resilient would help me be more compassionate. But really, compassion, you know, in the healthcare field, some people see compassion as actually something that can lead to burnout. If you're too compassionate, you have to be careful. And we all know why that we might have that idea. You know, we all have been around someone who needs our help a lot. Maybe it's a child or a loved one who's going through a really hard time, and it can be draining. But really what the research is telling us, and this research, compassion science is a new field, but it's happening. It's about 10 years old, and people are putting people in brain scanners and having them look at pictures of people suffering and figuring out what's happening. And it's pretty clear, not just with our program, but there are other compassion training programs, that doing these practices does help to bounce back when you're confronted with suffering, even really difficult images or stories of people suffering. But where I was headed was that what they're figuring out is the compassion is not draining, or in the nursing profession they call it compassion fatigue sometimes. Turns out it's not the compassion, it's the empathy that can be so fatiguing. It's the part of the experience where I'm actually mirroring the difficulties of others. And for some of it's just reading the newspaper. You know, if we think of all those refugees or people experiencing wars or people, when we hear about them, we feel for them. When we mirror their feelings or really put ourselves in their shoes, if we get stuck there sharing that same, which is very human, by the way. I mean, we're designed to resonate with the feelings of others. It's how we're built. But if we're stuck with that, that can be very draining. Compassion is not empathy. Compassion is when we have this empathic response that allows us to know someone is struggling. Compassion is the response of, I want to help. What can I do to help? It's that wish that the other person could be free from their struggles, their suffering. Turns out we don't have to sustain the empathic response to sustain that wish. All we need to do is continue to be aware of how much we appreciate this person, how much we do care about them. This may not make a lot of sense when you first hear it, but this is why our course takes a while to learn to distinguish between these responses in ourselves. And I think, you know, as a physician, you know, if you can think of that doctor who's been doing this emergency room medicine for 40 years and still comes in every day with a smile, ready to face the world. That's a rare person, but I bet you that person has figured this out. They're not being drained by their experience of confronting the suffering of others. They're attuning to what's wonderful about it. Here's a person I care for, and I can do something. I'm not going to solve all the problems. This gets back to self-compassion. I have limitations, of course. I'm not going to fix every problem I find. But how wonderful to be there and to do what I can, even if it's just to hold someone's hand or listen. So that's what we mean by compassion. And when people figure that out and realize they don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, and say, well, my only solution here is to not even care anymore about others. That's the only way I'm going to get through this. Well, if we make that decision, we're basically losing the whole joy of being a human being, which is that we are in relationship with others and we can help. We can do something to beyond our own little circle of just helping me, which of course is important. If I know I'm helping others, that's a meaningful life. That's a fulfilling life. So this connection is so important, and it's so helpful to have some skills and some knowledge to fall back on when we are feeling drained, are feeling worn out, burned out, and to realize I don't have to disconnect to solve this problem. All I need is to become more aware of my own emotions. And this is where it gets to your original question here. What are the practices? When I can take 10 minutes a day to slow down, watch my breath, settle my body, set all my distractions aside, and just attune to what's happening inside me. Some people do this through prayer in their religious faith. That's a wonderful way to do it. Some people seem to be able to do it while they're maybe swimming or going to yoga class. You know, there are many ways to do this. But the important thing is we have this time to begin to notice what's happening inside and to develop, this is the key, a more flexible response to our inner world. So many of us are on automatic pilot most of the time. Whatever emotion comes up, whatever trigger happens, we just go with it. We've all hit and send on that email. We've all hit send on that email and then immediately wish we could take it back. You know, what's going on? We're not noticing what's happening inside. This is where basic, any kind of mindfulness practice can be so helpful, to just take time, become more aware of these emotions that are flaring up from moment to moment, and not be so responsive. There's a gap we can start to develop. And in that gap is our resilience. You know, that's where we get resilience. I see it. I'm angry. I want to say this nasty thing to my colleague or my loved one. And then I say, you know, I don't have to do that. You know, the teachers in the public school system, this is one of their favorite parts of this practice. You know, so they don't have, you realize, I don't have to respond. I don't have to react to every feeling, every emotion. What a gift to myself, certainly a gift to those around me, right? It's a gift to my wife and my children. But that's where resilience comes. And that's where we start with those practices in CBCT.
Yeah, and you know, I'm so glad you made that distinction between compassion, which is just this general desire to want others to not suffer, versus empathy, which is carrying their suffering with you.
Yes.
And that's subtle but a very important distinction. And there are a lot of overlapping traits as well in all of this, because there's a lot of work on altruism. Mm-hmm. Stephen Post has done a lot of work around why it's good to be good, and there's been prior research on the benefit of volunteerism, the helper's high. Mm-hmm. So when people volunteer, they get a surge of endorphins, and how volunteering not only helps the recipient, but also the people who are volunteering their time. And this kind of builds on a lot of that work, or is a part of a lot of that work on how helping others can help. And it's just this beautiful, positive, virtuous cycle, as you point out, because you get more resilient as a result of that. You can do more to help others, and it just kind of self-perpetuates, which is kind of a beautiful place to be. And you touched on the process of kind of compassion, and it reminded me of just the Buddhist thought process of the Buddhist concept of the mind. Is there an overlap between that and CBCT?
When you say the Buddhist concept of the mind, can you say more?
Yeah, kind of in kind of the role of compassion towards others as a mindset in the philosophy. You know, when we listen to CBCT from probably a lot of, you know, the influences on U.S. culture, you know, kind of Protestant work ethic, a lot of Christianity is very different than, say, Eastern philosophies, which have more setting yourself free and setting others free of suffering, like a very different mindset. Is there work being done on any overlap with different philosophies, or is there a good context to put this in from Eastern philosophy?
Sure. It's a really good question. And a big one from the philosophical perspective. You know, I think it's the program is actually, because Dr. Negi, who developed the program himself, was a Tibetan Buddhist monk in the Dalai Lama's monastic academy in India for almost 30 years before he came to Emory and became a professor here. He's not a monk any longer. But he is steeped in this very scholastic training, philosophical, psychological, and it goes back to India, really, in the 200-880 period. They're still studying the texts from that period, you know, in his tradition. So certainly that's an influence. And in fact, there's a program in their tradition called Lojong, which translates as mind training, which is focused entirely on how an individual, a human being, can become as compassionate as possible in, you know, across their lifetime. And it's a multi-step process. And CBCT, in many ways, is based on the insights of that process. But what Dr. Negi is adamant about is that this is designed for people of any faith tradition or no faith tradition. And he's worked with emotion scientists and psychologists, psychiatrists, as I've mentioned, to be sure that this is something that would be available to anyone. Because really, in the end, well, two points. One, compassion, as I've mentioned, is a human skill or trait. It's not something that belongs to one religion or another. And the idea of extending compassion beyond your in-group is something you find in any religious tradition. If you look close to this golden rule, do unto others as they would do, you know, as you want them to do unto you. This is not saying, you know, do unto others in your family or in your, you know, your social circle, people you like, treat them nicely. It's saying, no, just because they're human beings, they deserve our care, our interest, you know. So, and again, you find that Karen Armstrong, who's a scholar on religious studies, has some wonderful work finding this basic idea in every religion she has ever looked at. Zoroastrianism, of course, Hinduism, Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam. So our experience is these practices not only go along with religious practice, but actually support it. And in fact, we're in our third year now offering CBCT as part of the training for all the chaplains in Emory's hospitals. Emory has 9 hospitals, actually now I think they have 12. And the director of education there, Maureen Shelton, took CBCD herself and said, oh, this is what we need, this reflective process to help our young chaplains, our new chaplains, become people who can handle this difficult work of being in the hospital, being called to the bedside in the most difficult situations, and sustaining their own resilience, their own compassion, all in the context of their own faith tradition. And it's been very heartwarming working with these chaplains and seeing how they're putting these basic, you know, CBCT is a skill building course. It's not philosophical. It's not faith-based. It's just, how do we use this human mind, this human body we've been given to be our best self? And so, is that answer
yeah,
some
I think
questions?
That actually summarized it just so well. I mean, that's the fascinating thing. Like, we can all benefit in just the broad applications to, you know, chaplains, to physicians, anyone who can go through compassion fatigue mm-hmm. as a parent, as yes. you know, as a caregiver. Mm-hmm. There's just this applicable to all of us. So thank you for sharing all that you've shared with us about this. And as a final question, I want to ask you, if you don't mind, a personal question. You got an architecture degree from Harvard University. What was your path to working in CBCT?
Well, that, again, another big question. Of course, you know, life is complicated, and there's, you know, any simple answer is not going to be the complete one. But basically, you know, I was a very type A person who enjoyed the kind of stress of a very, what I would call a hard-driving professional career. I worked for a firm, that amazing firm here in Atlanta, for over 10 years. And we just tried to do the best buildings possible. I was just constantly just working. And I found myself experiencing the stress at a level that didn't seem sustainable. And also, I began over the, in that process, discovered some basic meditations that helped me to see more clearly what I wanted out of my life, what would be more meaningful. I began to teach architecture at Georgia Tech, which I taught for about 8 years there as an adjunct faculty, and really enjoyed the interactions with the students, kind of most of all, you know, helping people do what they wanted to do, their designs. And in this process, I heard the Dalai Lama was coming to town. I went to hear him speak, and I heard about this CBCT program in 2010. Some of the initial research came out. And I thought, oh, that would be interesting to put my meditation practice in together with this idea of compassion, caring for others. By then, I'd had 2 children. And that really, more than anything, probably opened my eyes and my heart to the reality of how joyful it can be to really care for someone else and to not see yourself so much as the center of the universe. Which I'm afraid I should admit here that that's certainly something I was susceptible to seeing when I was younger. And so how to put all of that together, CBCT just seemed to do it for me. Then I became one of the certified teachers in one of the early cohorts, and I just took to it and wound up working part-time for Emory, and then now full-time, and now for 5 years I've been helping train the teachers and guiding the program, and it just kind of unfolded.
Yes. It's so fascinating just seeing how your path has evolved and how you just go where life takes you. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
And thank you so much for all the work that you do and for taking the time to speak to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sharon. It's been nice to meet you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.